This is the Education Gadfly Show.
The entire neighborhood was out in the cul-de-sac along with my husband. And the mailman came by with a mail. He's like, do any of you people work?
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Alyssa Schwenk of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming our special guest of the week, the solar eclipse of education reform, Jessica Sutter, the founder and president of EdPro Consulting. Welcome, Jessica.
Hi, Alyssa. How are you?
Yeah, no big deal with the name that I just gave you there.
I'm honestly humbled by that. That's pretty impressive.
Solar eclipse, yeah. So Mike's away this week, obviously, and we're joined with Brandon Wright as well. I didn't just wrest the mic. From Mike. Mike's out this week, so I get control of the show. It's my show. I was thinking perhaps to Kesha. I was thinking perhaps to Taylor Swift, because I never get to make my pop culture references, and
with
it's always
weird snake video.
Yes, thank you. That's something to discuss.
Very weird.
Thank
Pretty
you.
Weird.
Thank you. But I can never have these discussions because Mike's always like, here's a baseball player that did something inventive in the field. And I'm just like, I have nothing to add. But this week, I feel like we have to go with the solar eclipse because it was like the coolest thing ever.
It was. It was the coolest thing ever. I got to watch it in Raleigh where we were at 94%
totality.
Oh, wow.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Did you have the glasses?
We had the glasses, and I was actually with a bunch of colleagues. So we had a pack of about 10 of us with our glasses.
Yeah.
It was weird here. Unless you knew that the solar eclipse was happening, you wouldn't actually, like, the sun didn't actually change from a naked eye standpoint.
Yeah, but Brandon, you
like
did
it might have got a little cooler or like a little less bright, like at the peak, but
the shadows though, the crescents.
The crescents was cool. I built my own cereal box, pinhole projection, I believe it's called.
Awesome. Mm-hmm.
Took photos every like half hour, maybe 15 minutes, made them all into one photo and tweeted it. And I'm going to brag here, Capital Weather Gang, which is the Washington Post, like sort of famous Twitter account, retweeted it.
Capital Weather Gang is like a worthy brag.
They're legit.
That's awesome.
I immediately sent a text to my wife. Very excited.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Like they are one of those, like if you're not in DC, they're just like local celebrities on Twitter and they're so funny. And if they think you're funny too, that's like a nice little pat in the back there.
Absolutely. We had a 17-year-old with us watching and she said it looked like an Instagram filter had been put over the sky. So I actually thought that was a pretty good description of the tone change.
Yeah. Sure. All right.
I don't know. I was a humanities student. Like STEM was always not really my thing. And I was like, whatever, guys. But just seeing everyone and like in downtown DC, there were so many people like on the streets, staring glasses, like crowds in Farragut, like not to be cheesy, not to be sappy, but it was really cool to like see everyone come together and like collectively nerd out, which I feel hasn't happened in a while. But yeah, it was fun.
Everyone from like age 5 to 80 were actually like earnestly excited.
Yeah.
Which was really cool to see.
And there's nothing I like better than nerdiness. And that is why. Nice segue there. We're about to head into our Ed Reform update. This week, we are going to talk about what is unironically one of our favorite topics around here. Charter accountability. And it really is. It's one of those topics that we discuss a lot and we think about a lot around here. And Jess, you do a lot of research into the topic of charter accountability. So we thought this was a great thing to kind of bring back up. And it's been in the news a lot this year, in part because of a broader debate around accountability and choice, public school and private school. And last week, Secretary DeVos gave a interview to the Associated Press where she talked about in part, private school accountability. And while talking about private school accountability, she said that she thought that authorizers play an important role for charters. But on the topic of private school accountability, she thought the first line of defense was with parents. And Checker Finn read this, President Meredith here at Fordham, and decided to write a piece in response saying essentially, you know, if parents are the first line, well, what's the second line? So that's what we're going to talk about today, whether or not this parent-only or parent-mostly approach to accountability works for schools of choice, specifically charter schools. So that's kind of my question is like on this topic, there is this huge market-based movement that's definitely made a resurgence in the last couple of years. What do we see as the best first line for charter accountability? And Jessica, I know you are almost finished with a PhD looking at this topic.
Oh my God, so close. I can taste it. One of the things that's interesting about it is the research shows that most charter schools that are closed by their authorizers. And they're starting to get closed more often for academic reasons, mm-hmm. but they're closed for financial reasons, for mismanagement reasons. So parents as a first line is a nice thought, but the research doesn't bear out that parents walk away from schools that aren't keeping commitments to things like their charter contracts.
Mm-hmm. So I think, and Mike came up with a quiz a couple of months ago, and he wanted to call it a Cosmo quiz. I refused to let him use that term.
I think I took that quiz.
Yeah. And it's all about like, what kind of charter fan are you? And like, what level of autonomy are you comfortable with? And I think Mike was very much like, he's very comfortable like with a lot of oversight around financial issues, charter management issues, things like that. And those things are traditionally things that we've left to the authorizers and given authorizers authority over, if I'm remembering things correctly, right?
Yeah.
Like most authorizers in this country can close a school that's not being fiscally sound.
Yeah, there's usually like within state law, there's reasons a school can be closed, and they almost always include something about fiscal mismanagement or fraud or malfeasance. Issues of sort of organizational management get a little fuzzier in terms of what that means. They typically, the finances are sort of the lead off hit that something's happening. Here in DC, though, we've had a couple places where people got investigated by local authorities for management failures, and that led to closures of schools.
Yes, as I would argue they should.
Yeah, I would agree.
Another problem that I always think about when people talk about this sort of very market-based approach to school choice is, I mean, so say I go onto Amazon and I want to buy like a little speaker for my iPhone or something, right? I pay, you know, $20 or $50. I get it. I look at what reviews say and stuff and, you know, I get it and maybe I don't like it all that much, right? So I get another one or I don't use it or something, right? Opting for a school is a very, very different thing, right? Saying, well, this school, if it's bad, will close and it'll sort of solve its own problem, ignores all the problems that arose from it being a bad enough school to close in the first place.
Yeah.
Like, These are kids who are going to, if a school closes because it's bad, who have been going to a bad school for 3, 4, 5 years, even 1 year, even half a year. That's a problem. They're not going to get that education back. It's not just a widget. It is a school. It is an education that affects these kids' lives. It is therefore, I think, incredibly important to ensure that schools are good before they open, that they stay good, that parents get all the information they possibly can to, yes, be informed consumers and sort of vote with their feet to an extent. But there have to be other lines of defense, other lines of quality control.
Yeah.
And just the parent marketplace by itself doesn't provide that.
I would, yeah. And I think that's where Checker's argument about the public good really comes into play. And I do think parents are a good first line. Like, if you don't like your school, you should be able to move your child out of that school. And you should hopefully have gained enough information. And that's something else I want to talk about is this question of parent information to make that decision to based on the things that you find important and valuable in a child's education. But then, so my question before the question, though, is if parents are that first line, then what should that second line be? Are we looking at test scores? What should that second line just be? Financial management? And then I think we do get into this like values question.
I think, I mean, one of the things that's interesting when you were pointing out, Brendan, was this question of, you know, if I don't like my iPhone, I can pick another product. I can pick another thing. But that affects me. It doesn't affect anybody else. And the question of public good means that kids in low-performing schools academically affect society. It affects future citizens and what they know and what they're able to do.
That's a good point.
I think to your point about the second line, though, the question is, in most state laws, charters sign contracts with their authorizers. And in their contracts, they promise to do certain things. So one of the second lines is, if you promised to do this list of 10 things and you're not doing them, that's a good second line. So we're not measuring you against some abstract standard. We're measuring you against what you agreed to do and why we opened you in the first place. So if that was academic excellence, great. If that was providing a Montessori education, great. If that's performing for special education students in particular, then we need to be measuring you against what you said you would do and what we agreed to open you for.
This is an excellent point, right?
Yeah.
Because one of the great things about school choice is that different parents want different things for their kids and different kids thrive in different environments. Sometimes that's a rigorous academic school, right? That's sort of all about test scores and high performance and things like that. Sometimes it's not. And both of those are okay as long as the schools providing them are doing what they promise to, what they're designed to actually do. Yeah, I think you're exactly right that test scores can be a part of it, but it doesn't really have to be.
Yeah, and what I do like about that sort of frame is, you know, looking at the charter is one of the trade-offs, and I'm a firm believer in having strong accountability systems from a civil rights perspective, from a school accountability perspective. But one of the things that I recognize that has a, you know, disincentive consequence, which is if you're putting a lot of emphasis on tests, you're, you know, kind of detracting anyone who might want to open a school that really serves a high-risk population, whether that's pregnant teens, whether that's students with special needs, whether that's sure. dropout recovery, things like that. And I would argue that those are populations that especially need schools. So if our system is set up in a way to discourage people from opening potentially schools that work for those students, that's a problem for me too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that was interesting about Checker's sort of response to this was this piece about what the second line could be mm-hmm. also not in charter settings. And I think one of the things that's instructive about charter accountability is sometimes, and I know this is true in DC, there's an opportunity for a mission-specific indicator. Mm-hmm. So while there might be some standard indicators that an authorizer decides on to make sure they can measure everybody with some commonality, mm-hmm. they then allow for these specific things to say, okay, we're an arts-focused program, we're going to have these indicators that show our success, or we're working mm-hmm. with pregnant and parenting teens, and one of our indicators has to do with their well-being beyond the schooling day. Mm-hmm. So I think those are opportunities, too, for making sure that this second line is both accountable for the public good, but specific to the kinds of folks who might choose the school for their kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think also too, then getting back to this question, if their parents are the first line, a lot of that comes down, I think, to parent information. And I worked at a charter school that did have a specific mission focus, but also was not doing really well academically at the time that I was teaching there. And one of the challenges was who's giving these parents information, how accessible is this information? And I was always sort of skeptical that sending home a report in a kid's backpack from a test provider 6 months after, you know, the test had been taken, they've moved on to a different grade, was necessarily the best way. And then, you know, we'd have these kind of moments of crises in the school and parents would get really upset and have this, well, I chose this school kind of mindset about these crises. And it was just not a great communication environment. And so I think the question of information transparency and whether or not we're A, getting it to parents, but B, then also trusting parents to make the decision that's best for them is a really tough trade-off.
But in the Checker piece, he brings up as an example, right, the FDA, right? Mm-hmm. About how it is indeed important mm-hmm. that food has to say what's in it, how many calories, et cetera, mm-hmm. has to fit certain requirements of food safety and things to protect the consumer, because a consumer can't know everything. It can't just go to a grocery store where right. any food product can say anything right. it wants.
The jungle is a very
and then be book. Informed enough yes. to make safe and good choices, right?
Yeah.
So like there are some baseline sort of regs that need to be in there that to an extent could be interpreted as accountability that should be designed to ensure that parents are informed consumers and that schools just can't. And clearly most schools wouldn't do this, but if some schools are allowed to, some schools will, and that will affect kids who are going there. So schools can't just say or represent whatever they want to actually say,
mm-hmm.
right?
I think
have to be accurate and truthful.
I think beyond even just like what the school puts out, I think there's sort of two other things that come to mind with parent information. And one is like that reliable third party information source. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. like a consumer report style thing that you'd find for a gadget. Mm-hmm. You need that for schools. So mm-hmm. whether that's put out by the authorizer or if it's put out by a third party nonprofit organization with a
great
focus on
schools.
Quality, great yeah. schools. But then I think there's the other piece, which is, you know, when I was deciding which new iPhone to get, whether I should upgrade to the 7 or stick with my 6, I asked my friends mm-hmm. who has the 7, what do you like? What do you like? And I think parents do that too. They ask
oh, yeah.
their friends, they ask their neighbors, they ask their family members about schools they like, what they like about them. And I think that's when things get interesting, but also tricky, mm-hmm. Because that's where we have to trust that if a parent is selecting a school based on safety mm-hmm. or based on proximity, while that may not be the choice we make for our own child, mm-hmm. It's important for whoever's in charge, the authorities, the authorizers, not to negate
yeah.
those things that matter greatly to the folks who are doing the choosing.
Yeah.
Sort of a hiccup I see there, though, is, right, if I pick a phone, it's a pretty low stakes thing.
Totally.
There isn't anything that my phone says about me as like a person. There's no like personal failure if I pick a bad phone.
Right.
Right. If I'm picking a school for my child, right, A, I clearly think that that's a good school.
Mm-hmm.
B, if it turns out that it's a bad school, that would be very devastating to me as a parent, right? And when you see these surveys where you ask parents, how good is your kid's school? The vast majority of parents say my school is like very
yeah.
high quality.
Everybody
yeah,
loves their own
loves
school.
My school.
Yeah.
Everyone else
right?
is
and,
terrible.
And I think the psychology behind that is understandable and somewhat obvious.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, I think for a phone asking, how do you like your iPhone 7? Do you like the Android better, right? Fine. right? I think that's a great approach. But for schools, I just can't imagine a parent being like, well, Bobby goes to charter school A. It really sucks. But we're keeping him there, right? Like,
right.
No one says that.
Exactly. And that to me is a sort of baked in unavoidable flaw to such a system that relies, again, only on parents.
Yeah. It's interesting. I heard, I think it was Chris Stewart who actually said this at a parent session at a conference mm-hmm. I went to, about the fact that what parents are looking for is support, not to be told what to do. And mm-hmm. so I think part of this is maybe what we need to do in addition to providing information to parents is to provide accessible opportunities for parents to get support that mm-hmm. is both knowledgeable, but also considered trusted. Mm-hmm. So it's not the authorities telling me what to do with my kid, which could feel very adversarial.
Or yeah. worse, the authorities telling you that you done wrong.
Well, right. Like, that you picked
that's
badly.
That's the worst.
Or that you're not capable of yeah. picking a good school.
Sure.
So finding the balance on that, I think, is really tough. And I don't think we've cracked the nut on that. Mm-hmm. In most places.
Yeah, no, and I certainly don't think it's necessarily a nut that we're going to fully crack today, but I do think yeah. trying with these segues, you guys. But anyways, I do think that's all the time that we have for Ed Reform Update. Thank you so much, Jess, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Next up, Amber's Research Minute. And we're back with Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Alyssa.
Now, on Monday, did you, too, go outside with a pair of very thick
of
and weird glasses?
Course.
Wasn't it cool?
It was so cool.
I
had this huge cloud come, I don't know, did that only happen to me, like, right at 2:44 when it's supposed to be, like, the best time to see it where I live in Richmond? Big, huge cloud. I'm like, seriously, go away!
It was a little overcast in D.C., but it was, I mean, the glass, like, it's the sun. Like, yeah. It's very bright. If
yeah,
you put on the glasses,
bright.
It cuts
But
right
it was
through.
Cool. I got a nice crescent at one point that was yeah. just pretty striking.
Yeah, it was, I don't know. It was, as it was I was fun. Saying earlier, it was fun and nerdy and, like,
I know.
Just
I thought it was funny because, like, my entire, I live in a
together.
Little cul-de-sac neighborhood, and my entire neighborhood was out in the cul-de-sac mm-hmm. along with my husband. And the mailman came by with a mail. He's like, do any of you people work?
Which is awesome because, like, that's so rare now.
Yes,
right?
Yeah,
like,
that's right.
It seems like something you would see on, like, a 50s television show
that's
or something.
Right.
Yeah,
like,
that's
commonly,
right.
But now everyone is just, you know, inside or glued there.
Or on their iPhones.
Some sort of screen.
Yeah.
And, right. Like, that's actually what I like so much about it. Because here, yeah. I mean, you just saw a partial. So, yeah. like it didn't block out the sun. You wouldn't even know that it happened unless
right.
you knew it was going to happen.
That's right.
But it was sort of the community effect that I
yeah.
thought was actually really, really cool.
Me too,
and so rare.
Right.
Go science, go community.
I know.
Great
and I'm
day.
Like, I've got a 3 o'clock call, got to run, see you later.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming your research minute is not about science.
It is not.
Oh, what do you
it
got for
It is
us
about
today?
School safety, specifically in charter and traditional schools, comparing school safety in the two sectors. Really cool study. We hear a lot anecdotally that families who live in urban areas routinely cite school safety as one of the reasons for seeking out a charter school. And we have charter schools in Dayton ourselves as an authorizer. And I know we hear this a lot. From the folks who work with our schools, that they often choose mm-hmm. schools because parents perceive them as safer, the charter school option. But we actually don't know empirically whether that's actually true, if they're any safer than the alternative. So analysts focus their study in Detroit, obviously has an alarmingly high rate of crime and poverty. And this stat was horrendous. 55% of Detroit high schoolers reported being a victim of violence. 87% report having a relative or friend shot, murdered, or disabled by violence in the past 12 months.
87%.
Oh,
87%. That is heartbreaking.
Right. I mean, yikes.
And I'm from the area.
Oh, man.
Or, like, you know, the suburbs.
Nearby. That's
anyway,
right. Okay. Yeah. In response, the Detroit Public Schools established a school district police department. Like, literally have a police mm-hmm. department that's associated with the school. About 200 police officers and security personnel work in the city's traditional public schools. Anyway, nearly half of all students living in Detroit attend a charter school. I think it's the second largest sector. As for student demographics, approximately 91% of charter school students are African American, 87% economically disadvantaged. Those numbers are a little lower in traditional schools, about 86% and 79% respectively. Mm-hmm. Analysts link student reported survey data on school safety for 2014-2015. They combine the years. So it's questions like, how safe do you feel in the bathroom of your school? Mm-hmm. How safe do you feel in the hallway, in your classroom, outside the
building, so on and so forth. And then they link those data with school characteristics, student demographics, neighborhood characteristics, like the reported crime in the neighborhood. And this was interesting, the structural vacancy rate for city buildings. So how many empty buildings do you have that are closed up, boarded up, whatnot? Also average commute to the school, the distance, and parental involvement. So all that stuff, they're able to link to these student survey responses. And then they divide schools based on how far students on average commuted to them. So it's a lot of setup. But anyway, and the commuter schools tend to be a little further away than the neighborhood schools, obviously. All right. Key finding. Analysts find that traditional public schools show higher rates of reported crime in school and violent crime in school than charter schools. Initial findings also show that charter schools exhibited higher perceived safety than traditional public schools. It's about 0.68 standard deviation higher.
Wow.
Yet, and this is really the headline, once controls are added for student commute distance and parental involvement, these are the things that seek to control for the self-selection bias, because we know that more motivated parents may be disproportionately attracted to charter schools. So they try to control that through these parent involvement measures that teachers provided and the distance to school, because more motivated parents might be willing to travel farther. Okay. So once they do that, the differences mostly go away and they're no longer statistically significant. The one exception to that was the neighborhood charter schools. Again, these are the ones that are closer. They maintain their higher perceived safety rating even after the controls were applied. And the analysts start speculating. They say, well, that could be because these schools have highly structured learning environments. Maybe they have stricter enforcement of behavioral codes. But again, all that's speculative because they really don't feel like the study design was robust enough to be able to control for what else may be going on. So you can't really rule out the selection bias problem. And finally, this was the other thing. They found that neighborhood crime and structural vacancy were unrelated to school safety, which you would think, well, that's kind of odd. But they said that since crime is so pervasive in Detroit, there are very few low crime neighborhoods for these schools to locate. So there's probably no variation there for them to make much of. Bottom line, the study raises more questions than it can answer. There's suggestive evidence that charter schools that are closer to where students live are doing something right in the way of safety. But we really don't know definitively whether that's the case. So, hey, I like the study because there's this anecdotal feeling, right, and sense among parents that, oh, I'm going to, the charter schools are safer. We don't know. And this is one of a handful of studies that actually tries to look at it empirically. And unlike studies before it, it actually has some control variables in it that we didn't used to see in earlier generation studies. We need to do a lot more around this topic. So I like the study, even though it's not like, oh, here's this clear-cut finding I can share with our listeners. It just wasn't that way.
Seems interesting in that the study was somewhat hampered by the fact that so many parts of Detroit are so violent. But at the same time, it wouldn't make sense to do this study in, for example, a suburb. Like I said, I grew up 30 minutes from there. I never felt unsafe in my classroom or my hallway or my community, right? So like, it wouldn't make sense to do that in my suburb. So it's such an interesting issue. We talked about this before we started to record, how school safety is brought up so often when people just sort of talk about schools, but it's, people don't dive into it all that often. So it is good to see, but it's clearly a difficult subject to study.
Oh, that's right. And I like that they're asking kids.
Yeah.
Right? Because when you ask teachers, I mean, that's something different than when you ask teachers. When you ask kids, what are you experiencing? Like, teachers aren't in the kids' bathroom, right?
Especially with bullying and cyberbullying and kind of every new way that kids have found, because kids have always tormented each other behind a teacher's back.
That's
it's become much more pervasive in the ways in which they can do it
these
days.
And there's no reason for them to not tell the truth on a survey like this. You know, I mean, we talk a lot about survey bias, but it's hard for me to imagine that kids wouldn't feel like they could be honest on an anonymous survey like this.
It's also really nice and interesting compliment to the discussion we had earlier about charter accountability and parents' perceptions of charter schools. And frequently, at least in my experience, the fact that you choose a charter school because it then becomes a reflection of your parenting and your values and your choices as a parent, you're a little more invested in it, just in terms of like, well, I chose it, so therefore it must be a good choice, that kind of logic. And I feel like that could also apply to school safety. You've chosen it, so you perceive it as being safer than maybe it actually is.
Right. And the schools, by the way, probably know that, right?
Yeah.
So maybe, you know, inadvertently they're trying to amplify that perception of parents, even if they're not safer, right? But, you know, they can just capitalize on that and say, oh, we provide a safer environment without really having any statistics, because I know that parents think that, and why not tell them that? I mean, not that I'm thinking, I don't know that that happens, but I'm just saying it could be happening.
Yeah. And I do feel, and
again, kind of reflective of my own anecdotal experience being a teacher in a charter school in DC, a lot of the kind of steps that charter schools, I think, took maybe 15 years ago to either increase, you know, safety or increase orderliness within schools have been adopted in large part by public schools. You know, most schools in DC, whether they're charter or public, have a uniform, for instance. And I think that was something that maybe half generation ago was a signal to parents, like, this is a safer thing because there's less, because that's been shown to have an impact. Right.
Kids aren't going to tease one another because you're wearing your Walmart clothes and I'm wearing my Abercrombie and Fitch.
Or if you're between two territories that may have some gang challenges, like you can't wear those colors to school.
That's right.
So
You might have said it, but I didn't catch it. Aside from the charter district school comparison, what percentage of these kids in either school type actually did feel unsafe?
I don't think I had that. I didn't include it in my write-up. I didn't include it in my write-up. But I mean, I would guess that there weren't huge differences, especially once they applied the controls, you know. I'm guessing whatever it was, they're similar. But yeah, no, it's a good thing to dig into. Yeah.
Like how big of a problem it actually is.
That's right. You
know? Yeah. I mean, I could imagine. If we're asking the question, it's clearly something top of mind and therefore probably a problem, or certainly worth investigating.
I know. Sorry. It's a little depressing study, but anyway, we need answers to these questions.
Certainly an important question.
Yes. Yeah.
And a nice break from the usual sort of test results and proficiency.
Sure, I would say nice break, but I see where you're going there.
That's right. Yeah. Anyway.
A break at least. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
Detroit continues to need help. Good resources, supports, all that we can do in Detroit. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's not the most uplifting note that we've ever ended on, but that is certainly all the time that we have for Amber's Research Minute. Thank you, Amber.
Yes, ma'am.
And that's also all the time we have for this week's Gadfly Show. Till next week.
I'm Brandon Wright.
And I'm Alyssa Schwenk for the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.